university visa has always been controversial right from the beginning. In its early days, it was reestablished each year. And there were certain some years when it looked like it might not be reestablished until the very end of that fiscal year. So there have always been people who felt that the lottery as operated was not the best way to bring people into the United States. So
we have 5 seconds. Stephen Pattison, 5 seconds to wrap up.
Okay. So it could well be that the DV lottery will be removed as part of the RAISE program as well.
Stephen Pattison, we want to thank you for being with us with the State Department for 3 decades. We also want to thank Yolanda Rondon and Hamid Soufiane Omagrami. I'm Amy Goodman, headed to Belfast, Northern Ireland on Saturdays. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8 o'clock, and coming up next is Positively Revolting with Ani and Lynn.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month we'll screen the film Keep the Hives Alive on Thursday, August 10th at 7 p.m. Bees and other pollinators are declining at an alarming rate. An overwhelming number of scientific studies link these population declines to pesticide use. Keep the Hives Alive is a documentary film that shows the use of toxic pesticides are having far-reaching impacts on a wide range of environments, including beehives. Again, that's a film screening at the documentary Keep the Hives Alive, Thursday, August 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at the KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Books and Records! Books and Records! Come on down to KBOO's annual used book and record sale on Saturday, August 19th, noon to 6 p.m. at Cider Riot. There will be fabulous books, DVDs, CDs, and vinyl at ridiculously low prices. It's a fun community event that benefits your favorite community radio station, KBOO. Again, that's KBOO's annual used book and record sale on Saturday, August 19th from noon to 6 at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
Going on.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
And good morning, good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, your very own community radio station. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And we are positively revolting as ever. And this morning, we are excited to be joined with Kevin Van Meter, who is the author of the new book, Guerrillas of Desire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. I am really just enamored of the topic, everyday resistance, how we can, in fact, and how we are in resistance in a daily way against what, you know, you can call it late stage capitalism, you can call it the death cult that surrounds us, but against the system that exploits us all and exploits the world that sustains us. So let's just sort of jump straight to it, shall we? In the book, we talked briefly before the mics went on about a sort of a way of framing things in, as we're organizers, we organize, right? And we think as activists and organizers that we have to organize communities. And Kevin, you tell the story in the beginning of Guerrillas of Desire about your experience as a young person working with ACORN. And I just, I read this passage and I just thought, man, we've all been there. We know this one. Mm-hmm. Can you tell this story?
So, by working with ACORN, I should clarify that they didn't hire me.
Right.
You'll
and
hear
remind
why
people what ACORN stood for. If
the Association for Community Organizations for Reform Now. Originally, Arkansas was the A, as it was founded there. It came out of the welfare rights movement, which is a very underappreciated movement in the United States of the 70s. A welfare rights movement, a welfare rights union was arguably the strongest social movement in the United States, led by women of color, demanding less surveillance over their families, increased welfare payments, et cetera, et cetera. And as that movement wound down, ACORN emerged. But by the time I encountered it, or at least encountered this particular job interview in the early aughts, it was floundering in a number of ways, at least organizationally. It saw itself as pulling the Democrats leftward, and as we've all seen, they've done a fantastic job of that.
clearly,
a successful strategy.
Yes.
Clearly, the,
and as
the
it
right
continues, whatever.
Yes, drifting in the way we would expect it to. But they had a job position, and I needed a job. And I considered myself somewhat of an organizer at the time, and maybe even now. And during and for this particular interview, the lead organizer for the Long Island chapter and I went around, at that time, at least a predominantly African-American and El Salvadorian community. And we door knocked. We knocked on this door, we knocked on that door. And typically, we would ask for a $5 membership fee or donation. Give us $5, sign up on our list, join an organization. And in this particular instance, we were organizing and soliciting donations for childcare. Give us $5, get on our mailing list, maybe come out to an action or what have you. And we were going to ask our elected representatives to provide childcare, because there weren't really well-funded childcare facilities then, now, or really ever.
I was going to say, thank you, honest. Yes.
And it was interesting. I'm white, from middle-class background, cisgendered, heterosexual. The other organizer was female-identified, but still white and middle-class educated background. And we're predominantly in a neighborhood that's predominantly African-American and El Salvadorian, immigrant communities, poor communities. And in Long Island is the, at least at that time, the second most segregated place in the country after Detroit, which people don't often think about. But those kind of invisible lines.
If you've been to Long Island, you would know
yes.
that. Yes.
Luckily, most people hearing this probably have not been and will not go and should avoid at all costs. But in crossing those invisible boundaries, we, or at least I at the time as a young organizer, didn't think about what these encounters would be like. How do we listen? How do we not just solicit or recruit or proselytize? And shortly into this 6-8 hour interview, I realized that the lead organizer was not listening to the people they met. We'd knock on a door, and they'd say, hey, give us $5, join our mailing list, and we're going to fight for your right for childcare. We're going to demand that our elected representatives provide childcare. And the response we most often heard was people saying, we have childcare. The person down the block, the elderly couple in the building, parents were trading on and off particular days in order to make sure that their kids were cared for. And I started to hear this, and part of that was my anarchist and punk background, but the lead organizer, this was not a reality they could hear. This is not childcare. Childcare is something that we demand that the state provide, and then it does or doesn't. And as we know, it doesn't. And I started to think at that moment and various other moments that the way that we were going about organizing was completely wrong. And if we look at the wages for housework movement and other feminist movements of the 60s and 70s, the demand that those movements were making was not that we ask our elected representatives of the state or some company to provide childcare, but in fact, we create our own childcare, or we utilize the childcare networks that people utilize to survive and expand upon them and then demand the state pay for it. Because one of these things extends the state's power over us. Another thing, we extend our power over our larger communities. And these are not the same act. One requires attentive listening, coordination, circulation, amplification of struggles that already exist. The other is begging for handouts. And as we've seen, the state is not going to provide childcare and arguably will never provide childcare. And if it did, it'd be subpar at low wages. And what we need to do is actually think about these larger social questions and how we can approach them in different cooperative and productive ways.
And at the heart of that is mutual aid. I mean, really, it seems like poor communities, working class communities, immigrant communities already know mutual aid, sort of from the inside out. It's folks that have been fairly comfortable in their lives that have been able to be alienated enough to not understand that concept. Can you explain mutual aid for people that might not be so familiar with the term? What does that mean?
Sure. Mutual aid is, as Peter Kropotkin, author of the book Mutual Aid, a factor in evolution, would argue that competition is not all that defines human societies and the natural world. In fact,
hopefully,
yes. Though he sees that as an important element because there are bonds that will crystallize in communities, and sometimes they need to be broken through, as we've seen in all sorts of ways that we could talk about in a second. But mutual aid is that other factor, that cooperative factor, that real need and desire for human beings to touch one another, to be together, to work together
community.
Toward common goods, to have community.
Right.
And really, this is mutual aid's way of describing that underpinning of social life, or the way I phrase it in the book, and I did at a talk at Powell's last night, is collective life, right? Collective life is far beyond a family unit or a religious denomination or where you go on Sunday, et cetera, et cetera. It's this social fabric, this substance of which then capital and the state are vampiric upon. The state creates all kinds of fears and expectations and presumes that it's the only thing that can defend one another, even when it doesn't provide us child care or health care or other basic services. Mutual aid is that kind of basic element of the cooperative tissues that allow all of social life to exist. And as an anarchist and as anarchists have identified, this is an important factor, not just in the society we live in, but hopefully the society that we're in the process of creating. So mutual aid unto itself is an interesting concept, but we also want to make sure that we bring in solidarity, that real need and desire to be with one another, that sense of trust, but also the need for communication, because if you can't communicate about your needs and desires in a substantive way, in a productive way, in a trusting way, you can't actually provide for one another in the concept of mutual aid. So really, there's a number of things that come together that allow the social fabric to work, very often allow counter communities to exist that everyday resistance can arrive out of or other overt struggles can arise out of. But also, this is the substance of life of which without none of us could exist.
That well, is, well put.
And capitalism has done its best, and this has been going on for some time now, to subvert that.
What I would argue is that we are the dominant force. Social life is the dominant force. Capitalism requires one commodity over all other, and that is labor power, mm-hmm. the worker's ability to work, right? And yep. Where does that come from? That comes from social reproduction, from housework, from work that's predominantly done without a wage by women and gender nonconforming peoples. This is work done for free so that the worker, at least in the traditional household, right, the male factory worker would come home and the wife and kids would make sure he'd be ready to go for work the next day.
Mm-hmm. Well, even in role reversals, there's still the person that's at home.
Doing that work.
Yes, and the person that is outside the home is more important. Whoever, whatever gender they are.
Because that work
quote
is
unquote.
Arguably important,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. I'm air quoting.
Oh, we're seeing those. Making sure everyone else is hearing those.
Right, I was going to say, it's hard to see those through the speakers
I know,
sometimes.
I know.
But without that labor power, right, without the worker's ability to work, there is no capitalist production. There are no commodities. There are no markets. There is no profit. Nothing is to circulate without labor power. Labor power arguably is the primary commodity that capitalism needs to survive. And it's figured out a really nice way of not having to pay for that at all, ever. And increasingly, we're seeing that imposition of unwage work on the general population. So if we're looking at the Bureau of Labor Statistics website, as I did yesterday, studies as recent as 2015 show, I'm not talking about caring for children or elderly or the actual process of helping a worker wake up and get off into the day, just buying food, cooking, cleaning, taking care of the garden, et cetera, et cetera.
Dishes.
Dishes, all those things. Still, as of 2015, and the statistics that they provide are only of men and women, but women perform an hour more of this work every day than men, still after 40 years of feminist struggle, right? And when they're not even considering all this other work, right, the physicality, the emotions involved in caring for children and the elderly and those who happen to be ill, et cetera, we can add hours upon hours upon hours upon hours on that, right? So one of the things I want to make sure to bring up in the book and bring up in various talks is that, in fact, this is work that is going to be done now and it's going to be done after the revolution, right? Or in a new society or in a better world.
This is the work that is constant, regardless of how society is, regardless of the widgets the society may be producing, or if a society chooses not to be, you know, technologically inclined towards widgets at all. Mm-hmm. This is still the work of our species. This is the work that mm-hmm. must be done if we continue.
And we need to challenge that gender division of it. We need to challenge how it's not being recognized. And then, of course, we see home health care aides. Mm. We see nurses. We see other quote-unquote feminized work that is within that realm of care and support work that is horribly paid, right? Mm-hmm. That isn't respected. And how important that is for literally the species to exist and continue to exist. And what I would argue is because labor power is the most important commodity under capitalism. In fact, we are the primary force and capitalism is vampiric, to use Marx's term, off of this social life, our cooperative capacities, our living labor, our actual labor power. And what capitalism does is it sucks and it sucks and it sucks and it sucks that life force out of us as we produce things, as we reproduce one another, et cetera, et cetera. And at those very moments that's being imposed, very often on individuals, so someone who's driving right now and heading off to work, they expect to get 2 tens and a 30 in an 8-hour day, right? Sometimes you take that 15. Sometimes you take 20. Because 10 minutes is not enough to call and make a doctor's appointment. It's not enough to call in and see how little Johnny's doing at daycare, right? Because mm-hmm. life itself is not fit into 10 minutes, 2 10 minutes and a 30. And because it's not, very often just to actually exist in this world, people need to resist that imposition of work. And in the book, I talk about how this work is imposed upon individuals at an individual job, right, which we've all experienced, but also work is imposed upon the populace. Because if you don't work, you don't get a wage. You don't get a wage, can't buy food, clothes, housing, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a regime of work that's imposed upon the population because capitalism has been very well at doing away with all other means of subsistence and survival outside of the wage relation or dependency upon the state, right? And because this is imposed as a relation, the absence of work is also an imposition of work. Because when there is no work and you're struggling to get work, to get a wage, there's still a social condition and a mechanism of social control that's being imposed upon you.
Oh, yeah. And in this country, it's very expensive to be poor, but that's another story. How do you feel about the guaranteed wage?
Basic income.
Yeah, basic income.
Basic income is interesting. This comes up a lot.
Who is Norway doing it now?
There's a little experiment in Oakland. There's little projects here and there. The thing with basic income is that this is a demand that came out of European social movements and feminist struggles in the 70s and 80s. Basic income is the idea that no human being should not get a basic income for existing.
Novel concept.
It's basic.
Yeah, pretty basic, right? Basic income, you don't need to explain much more than that, right? It's pretty clear what we're talking about here. And that would be for food, shelter, education, clothing, et cetera, et cetera. very basic things. And as a demand that came out of these social movements, the argument was, once we had a basic income, first off, we would not allow anyone to fall below that, right? Outside of the means of subsistence in the society we actually exist. So not just basic as a little here and there, but actually basic that allows people to reproduce themselves, which who's going to peg that? Is it going to be a political struggle if, say, that's put on the national agenda, right? What is that wage? What does that actually look like? Because as we know with your 15 Now sticker, that even 15 Now is not enough to live in Portland.
No, that 15 Now was enough to live in Portland when that movement started.
Yes.
You know.
And not even well, but still live.
Exist,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, that was an important demand to see if we can actually reach that horizon, which we haven't yet.
Right.
And then, of course, that line has been moved by the real estate interests and capital. But this idea of basic income came out of these social movements and feminist struggles because the idea was that there's more to life than just obtaining wages, right? That, in fact, children did need to be cared for. And if everyone was receiving a wage, then maybe we could reorganize unwaged housework and care work along more equitable lines. Also, that would simply allow us to participate in the political and the civil and the cultural and the social aspects of human existence. And that would seem to be important.
I mean, those things that enrich our lives and make us actually human, that make us that feel alive and connected, those seem important too. It's good to be able to get around to those. And it's hard. It's absolutely brutally hard to get around to those after you've worked a 10-hour day, you know, doing something for somebody else's enrichment so that you can sustain a modest, you know, living.
And I can't help but think about all the talents, ideas, cultural products, really how we've, because folks are forced to work 10-hour days at jobs that shouldn't exist to produce things that we don't need. Over and over and over and over again, right? Because capitalism is not just the imposition of work, but the endless imposition. It imposes work, so it can impose more work, and then more work, and then more work upon that, right? And when we don't have wage work, then that means we have to do more work outside of that in order to survive. So if, in fact, this is the world that we live in, where are all these individuals, all these collectivities that could emerge and produce new cultural products, new discoveries, new ways of being with one another? And actually, we're harming ourselves as a species.
You know, I've watched some people who are lucky enough to be able to afford to retire, mostly teachers. And it's been interesting to see how freaked out people are when work is not the central force in their life anymore. Our neural pathways are completely skewed in that direction. And, you know, it takes a lot of work to get out of that and start being able, like, they're like, oh, I can do those creative things I wanted to do. I can do. And it makes me incredibly sad that people have to wait till the end of their, till they're older to be able to do that. Though people should be able to retire from work. But the whole issue of work, it's so wrong. I don't know what else to say.
The way we've set this up, I think what Lynn is trying to say is,
no, I said it. I know what I said, Annie. I said, it's so wrong.
Yeah, okay. Who can argue?
You described my mother there, right? In a lot of ways.
I'm like I said, I'm old enough to watch people who are lucky enough to afford to retire, and now a lot of them get it together and finally realize that they can do things. Other people die because they can't take the stress of not working. This is it's a very complicated and serious issue.
I want to jump in and remind people you are in fact listening to Positively Revolting. This morning we have the pleasure of talking with Kevin Van Meter, the author of Guerrillas of Desire. And our number here, you can join in this lively conversation. Please do. Our number is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Also, you can find us and like us, because we like to be liked, on Facebook. You can also follow along on Twitter, at Positive Revolt. And let's go ahead and listen to you, dear listeners. What do you have to say this morning on the topic? Marion has called in. What do you have to say, Marion? Good morning.
Good morning, Annie. And good morning, Kevin.
Morning.
I was at Kevin's talk last night. at Powell's on Hawthorne, and I'm very impressed with his book. Two things I wanted to bring up. One is that Kevin was gracious enough to allow me to collect names of people who are interested in a consciousness-raising discussion study group and support group of personal action, which will be happening later this month. We're coordinating times right now. If you're interested, you can email me, Marion, and my email address is postcards, postcards, at heavenet.com. Heavenet is a local company. Spelling is H like heaven, H-E, excuse me, H-E, V like Victor, A-N-E-T.com. So come on down. It's going to be at Powell's downtown in the coffee shop, so you don't even have to buy anything. The other thing is, you mentioned just now, quote, unquote, the whole issue of the great, the whole issue of work is so wrong. I say the whole issue of the great American workplace is what is so wrong, not committed work itself. And I don't think he's saying that anyway. But as for me, I was never good at the great American workplace. I've had many jobs. What I did was I started my own businesses. I had a secretarial service that grew so fast I couldn't handle all the work, and I sold it for enough for a down payment on a house. That was very unusual, but it worked. I also taught independent piano for 20 years. Not everybody has the talents to do these things, but there's all kinds of things you can do to work for yourself and find ways to finance it without going into heavily into debt. I worked part-time to finance it. And I also had family help. So just letting you know, there are ways that you can do this. One guy that's worked for me, he created a job reupholstering cat furniture. He would come to my house, take my cat tree away, and bring it back all nicely with new carpet on it. All kinds of creative ways that people can work without being part of the great American workplace.
All right, Marion, thank you very much for calling in and giving your contact information. Do you mind if we amplify that by putting it on our Facebook page?
Fine.
Cool enough. Thanks very much for your call this morning.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Cheers. And it seems like, you know, the idea of, let's talk about work. Let's talk about what it means to be a worker and the alternatives thereof. One of the examples, I just love thinking about slacking as an act of resistance, because even in my head, I have to admit, I absolutely identified as a slacker. My one and only for-profit job, right? For-profit being in heavy quotation marks. It was a book industry job. It was the only time I didn't work for a little, you know, nonprofit social service, let's change the world together kind of place. And so So I didn't have the same motivation to, let's just say, be productive, because I didn't really care about the president of the company and if I was actually making the car payment on his new BMW when I was walking to work because I couldn't afford a car. I didn't care about that. I enjoyed being surrounded by books. And I realized very quickly that no one kept track of how many I processed. So I spent 6 hours a day reading and 2 hours a day processing books. And I was enjoying myself and collecting just above minimum wage, God knows, because it's a book industry job. No one gets paid well in the book industry, no. Right? Including authors, I do believe. And yet, I never really saw that as resistance. I saw that as a way of surviving a capitalist job. I talk about the idea of slacking as resistance.
So in the book, I identify a whole set of practices. I call it a taxonomy of struggle, right? All these kinds of everyday resistance practices that actually are quite common under slavery in peasant societies throughout the industrial and social factory. So both in, quote-unquote, we might see as a traditional manufacturing sector, but also in service jobs, in book jobs, in nonprofit jobs, especially, because they're usually terribly paid.
And incredibly overworked.
And incredibly overworked. And really with, I think it's interesting because very often we have this idea that if we could just create a couple of cooperatives, if we could have some small businesses, if we could move from more of a for-profit to a not-for-profit model, somehow the exploitation will be lessened. And I've never understood how you can get rid of the exploitation and keep the work. In fact, actually, it all must go.
Yes.
It all must go. Yes. Because very often the reason that wages are paid so low in the nonprofit sector, and this is not the only reason, of course, this is a complex subject matter, is that the idea that you're doing good, that no, you don't need a union here. No, you don't need to make more than minimum wage. Yes, you should work 60-hour weeks, even though we're paying you for 40. Because what we're doing is to make the world a better place or provide social services, et cetera, et cetera. And I think
That's crazy.
I'm just going to jump in and say, if I had a nickel for every time I heard from a boss that I should be thankful that I'm being paid for revolutionary work, mm-hmm. and I need to be grateful, and that's why I shouldn't get a break, and I should go ahead and not clock in my overtime.
Nonsense.
And I shouldn't file the workers' comp claim when I fall down the flight of stairs. Mm-hmm. All of those things that have happened to me in nonprofit work. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Feminist Women's Health Center. You know, just it is phenomenal to me that we do actually engage wholeheartedly in our own exploitation in the name of making the world a better place.
Mm-hmm. And very often that's how unwage housework.
Yeah.
Right? It's a natural condition. It's something that's caring that people should want to do. But yet, it isn't when the boss is your husband, when this work is being imposed at a particular rate where you have very little control over it. Mm-hmm. Socially, within the larger society, in the same sense that our cooperative capacities are being vampirically stolen by capital, because this could be something you want to do. I happen to really enjoy teaching. I happen to really enjoy spending time, I don't even want to use the word mentoring, spending time discussing important issues and topics and the lives of students and, of course, my own, right? Mm-hmm. This is a kind of relationship that that instructors have and professors have with their students. I just don't like not being able to feed myself while I do this. And mm-hmm. I don't want the institution.
Oh, you greedy little thing. See, yeah. that's the attitude that is so – we have just been – the PR – people have been brainwashed big time. It's almost as much as American, I'm blanking on the American supremacy, American exceptionalism, mm-hmm. that's the word I want to use. So you have ideas for how to help folks break, it's a wall to break through.
I would actually argue that it's already taking place. So there's a really good example that I've used in my talks and I reference in the book.
Good.
These are wartime strikes that took place in Detroit against the war machine during World War II. So you have good old white patriotic American men who signed through their unions or individually no strike pledges. We will not strike as long as the war is on because we are going to defeat Germany and Japan. Mm-hmm. Et cetera, et cetera. We're not going to strike. Well, in fact, they struck all the time. Wildcats against the union, against the no strike pledge, because they were not making enough money with the wartime inflation in order to survive, to feed their families. So they were involved in wildcat strikes quite often. That is something we might want to point to and say, hey, this is interesting. What's taking place here? That their consciousness, quote unquote, if you spoke to one of these individuals, they'd say, oh, yes, no, I'm a good patriotic, hardy American man. Mm-hmm. When we look into these strikes a little closer, not only are they striking for higher wages, but often they're striking against the inclusion of black workers and women in the plant, right? Mm-hmm. So these are complex relations. And while I'm pointing to everyday resistance practices such as wildcat strikes as something where we're going to see the new society or the socialist society emerge from, in fact, it's not the only factor we need to consider. There's other issues we want to point to. And I think consciousness is immensely complex. And we're too often, I think, on the left, and that's who's mostly listening, I presume, have this idea that if we could just change the consciousness of people, if people would just be educated, then somehow the larger swath of social relationships would change. And I don't buy it. I don't think consciousness and what we think is that important, in fact, that actually our encounters with power educate, our encounters with one another educate, that in fact, if we look at the left and radical communities and we look at the level of intimate violence and sexual assault that takes place there after 40 years of feminist struggle, and we look at the larger society, I would suggest they're almost identical. So in fact, those who have been educated into the quote-unquote correct consciousness around the importance of
Yeah, but if you're being
consent,
violent to someone, you don't have correct consciousness.
Yeah,
quote-unquote. I don't even want to say correct consciousness because I don't know it's something that I particularly believe in. But if you're still being violent to women...
Go ahead and finish.
I would say that, in fact, what you believe... Mm-hmm. The idea that that has a impact on your actions, how you act in social relationships with one another, I don't buy that if people are quote-unquote educated or convinced are going to fundamentally change, or in fact, if they're violent towards women.
Or whoever,
gender nonconforming folks, in an intimate relationship. You could literally go down through the checklist and they've read the right things and they've been to the right classes, et cetera,
Absolutely.
Et cetera. Because, in fact, these are more complex than the idea that we can shift people's consciousness and educate them. Mm-hmm. And I think the left has, for 150 years, been convinced in this idea that if we educate people to the correct consciousness, then everything else follows. And I think, actually, the reverse is true, that we need to create new kinds of spaces and new kinds of relationships. And when we create those new kinds of spaces and relationships, consciousness, which is co-determined by those spaces and relationships, will also change. And I think the idea that we can just convince people that, and this is by no means to not point out the incredible work that has been done by feminist struggles, predominantly by women of color, over the last 40 years to challenge this issue, to bring spousal rape, domestic violence, intimate violence out into the public realm, that in fact the private space of the home is not a place that we all should be able to go to prevent these kind of violences from taking place. And of course, violence against trans and gender nonconforming people that takes place in homes. And I think if, in fact, we want to fundamentally change these social relationships, education and consciousness is insufficient. That we have to actually talk about how these relationships function.
I guess I think of that as consciousness. Maybe I just have a different definition of that than you do. Because, yeah, it's not just about, it's not a mental process. Is that what you were saying?
It's an embodied process.
Yeah.
It's a set of relationships. And I also come from a very particular philosophical tradition, so I reject the idea of free will and that as individuals we can solve these problems, right?
Yeah.
So as an individual, I can read all kinds of things. I can go to therapy. I can challenge the patriarchal masculinity of which I've been raised in and presume that I'm supposed to emulate, et cetera, et cetera. I can do all that. But it's not enough. I need to do that in concert with others. This is a larger collective process of us as a society, us as a community, moving through and undoing some of this damage and some of this violence that has been done. And we can, you know, play around with these different definitions and how this functions, but I don't think education, agitation, or organization actually is sufficient.
No, I agree.
And also, that also presumes that people aren't organized, that aren't resisting these things,
right?
Right, and that's an assumption, again, that I'm going to say often white activists make when working, period, that we tend to come at things as the savior. Mm. You know, we have at least a modicum of an answer. It might not be the complete answer, and we might actually be with it enough to understand that we don't have the capital T, capital A answer. But we think that we have at least a good blueprint, and therefore we're going to bring it to you people who haven't been educated yet. Look, I can help save you. We can do this together. I've got a plan. Join me. You know,
and relax, people. You don't have to have the plan. Other people are doing it. Relax.
Well, follow me. You know.
It's
let's just say unsatisfying at best. And in fact, I think it's counter-revolutionary.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the major claim that I make in the book, and I open most of my talks with this, is that the underlying assumption of left and radical organizing, the underlying presumption is wrong. Not ideologically incorrect, not immoral, not organizationally dishonest, is empirically wrong. The assumption that people are not organized or are not resisting in their everyday lives, I can show, and I think hopefully I've shown in
200 pages or so.
Yeah, 200 pages or so, leaning on the work and thousands and thousands and thousands of pages on slaves and peasants and workers in all kinds of other environments. I think I can show that over the 500 years of capitalism, that's not true. People are resisting. People are organized in their everyday lives. And I think it's a different kind of approach as an organizer to say we want to amplify, circulate, produce knowledge about these struggles, to listen to these struggles, to read these struggles. That's a fundamentally different approach than presuming that we have a plan, because everyone wants to steer and nobody wants to row. Right?
Oh, so true. Yeah, right.
And just to further that point a little more, when leftists and radicals talk about organizing, they talk about the organization they're part of on up. How do we create a local coalition around wage theft? How do we create a federation in the Northwest of anarchists, et cetera, et cetera? Right? We've all heard these. My question is why no one asks about the organization all the way down. How do organizations emerge? Where do they come from? Who told the hallowed stories that allowed these groups to come together in the first place? What kind of experiences did you have that brought you to these kind of organizations at all? Why did you involve yourself in this? Why don't others involve themselves in these things? So I want to start asking the questions, not from the organization, how do we create coalitions or federations or a municipal council or a general strike, but actually ask from the organization on down, how do the organizations emerge? What kind of processes do we need that is going to allow the social fabric to reweave itself and then other kinds of organizations to arise out of actual needs and desires, not the presumed needs and desires that we think people need or maybe I want, so that means other people might want that as well. But also I think it's important to note that these things can only take place in context. When you're listening, the needs and desires of someone in Portland is not the needs and desires of someone in rural Oregon mm-hmm. or rural Vermont where my parents live mm-hmm. or suburban Long Island where I grew up, right? These are going to be different needs and desires, different demands, different cultural and social pathways, different ecological systems. These are fundamentally different questions. So as soon as we create this universal plan or idea, in fact, we lose that context.
Absolutely. I want to remind people you're listening to Positively Revolting Talk Radio. It is about 20 minutes till 9 in the morning. It means that we are soon to be running out of show. If you want to join us in the conversation, please jump on in, 503-231-8187. We are talking this morning with Kevin Van Meter, the author of Guerrillas of Desire. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And we invite you to follow along throughout the week on Twitter at Positive Revolt or on Facebook, Positively Revolting. We are there. I also want to let you know that coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 o'clock, the beloved community looks at how the changes in modern culture are affecting organized religion. At 10 o'clock, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, The Digital Divide looks at how the latest technologies affect our communities and how we can use science to benefit society and keep it from harming us. KBOO keeps you informed and involved about all of these things and oh so much more throughout your day. We also inspire through music and keep people together with toe tap and tunes, all manner of cultural, artistic, and all manner of things that bring us together and keep us in resistance. That's KBOO, your community radio station. You can make it your very own community radio station when you, in fact, join us. Become a member. If you haven't done that yet, go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button. You can do it. You can take care of that and know that you are doing something to care for your community resources that allow us to have really great conversations like this.
Like this. You know, what I see and what I hear is you're going after the ego. I don't mean to get psychological, but that's where I go with things. So I guess I do.
Well,
so that
Lynn.
Was going after the ego of the left. Mm. And I like that because especially as white people, we are intrinsically brought up to think that we know everything. Mm-hmm. And it's so important to just step aside, as I said before, and let other people who know what they want take action. And I do love, I love personal sabotage of capitalism. I just think I love to hear those stories, and to me it's much more interesting than going to a meeting where you're going to try to organize people to do things they may or may not want to do. I know Ani worked a lot with the Occupy movement, and I bow down to her, but oh my God, it makes the top of my head blow up. I tell you,
I liked it.
I know.
I was working a 60-hour shift on Swan Island a week during that, so I fortunately missed.
You're here. You wanted sleep sometime of that? Kevin.
I need more coffee, honestly. Let's be honest, what's happening here?
Indeed. Just a moment or two ago, we were talking about changing consciousness and how changing consciousness really can't happen in a vacuum. And Kevin, you had talked about how we actually need to create new spaces and relationships and create new relationships to power and really look at things through those means. And then when we do that, we change consciousness. Can you talk about what creating new spaces and new relationships looks like?
Well, so technically, I'm an academic geographer.
I like that.
And the only thing that geography has that all the other social sciences does not have, at least I was told, was jobs. That's not true. I wanted to be a political theorist and a poet and a whole bunch of other things, but there were no jobs in any of those. So they said, hey, become a geographer. There are jobs. There are slightly more jobs than other social sciences, but really not any jobs
not
at all.
Many.
Not that many. And not
social science? Who needs that? Okay.
Not when I get Googled after doing this book and talk today. I don't think someone's going to hire me to work after this.
That is hilarious. Yeah, okay. Carry on.
But this thanks for coming anyway.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that. I know I've just torpedoed every possible career I could possibly have after this. Where were we?
about creating that new space.
Spaces and relationships. So as an academic geographer, I'm interested in how space functions under capitalism. And French theorist Lefebvre suggested that no revolution will be complete until it creates new kinds of spaces. And what I try to share with my students and get my students to experience, and how I try to get in my activist work and in my both academic and activist writing, is to talk about how different spaces are going to function. And I don't mean just how they're produced or reproduced, but really how they feel. Because when you walk through a particular corridor, or you walk through a public space, how does that space feel? And also, how does that space feel different for different kinds of bodies and different kinds of experiences, right? Mm-hmm. And if my roommate, who presents as female and is female identified, walks home from a bar the same street that I do at the same time of night on the same day, we have different experiences of that space. And how, in fact, do we create a space where that violence and fear that they experience doesn't exist, right? Because it doesn't exist for me. And what I want to put on the political agenda is not just simply that we need to discuss these issues or raise these issues, but actually how do we create different kinds of relationships with those kinds of spaces so that the walk from the bar to home for one kind of embodied experience is actually the same for another. And not on the level of that we're all experiencing violence, but in fact, we all feel that kind of level of safety and comfort, and that we can actually engage in that space and produce that space and have a quote-unquote right to the city or right to that public space. What that looks like is going to be co-determined with the kinds of relationships that exist in that space. Because in fact, walking from the bar to home is a kind of relationship with that quote-unquote embodied real space, that built environment with that ecology. But also, it's because of the relationships we've allowed to continue in our world that that space is constantly reproduced. So when my students walk into a classroom, they expect a very particular kind of experience. I stand in the front. I tell them what they think. They write it down. They take an exam, right? The seats are set back Coliseum style.
Kind of, yeah, right, pretty much.
Right?
Right.
And it's unidirectional, right? Mm-hmm. We know what that relationship is supposed to look like. Well, because I teach predominantly advanced geography courses at Portland State University, and we have small class sizes, at least I'm lucky enough to have small class sizes, and maybe that's me. We try to play with that space. What would that be like if we're in a circle rather than in Coliseum-style seating? Well, the kind of interactions you have with each other in that space is different. So we can reorganize that space. We can reorganize the relationships that exist in that space. And I think with your experience in Occupy, right, mm-hmm. utilizing that kind of public space to have different kinds of relationships. Now, the question is, how is that not just temporary?
Right.
How is that? How does that become permanent? Because if we have not fundamentally changed the spatial relationships under state and capital, we've in fact not changed the social order in a meaningful and substantive way. And I don't know how we do that, and I should not have an answer on how to do that. That's an answer that needs to
That's
arise.
That's totally refreshing.
Yeah.
Thank you for not having an answer and not pretending to have an answer.
Which frustrates my students on the first day, and by the end of the term,
they start thinking and it's okay.
I hope so, at least.
Yeah, yeah.
Because these are answers that need to arise in context, mm-hmm. from the embodied and effective experiences that take place there.
And it's an answer that will change from space to space.
Really? Yeah, I think so.
Hell no. Let's go ahead and talk to Sol. Sol is the next up this morning. Congratulations. And good morning, Sol. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I just have a comment. I do environmental work in the rural parts of Cascadia. And one thing that I see coming from this sort of divide, I mean, it's the classic rural-urban divide, especially on environmental issues. And I think a lot when they ask themselves, well, how could people in the countryside possibly vote for someone as repugnant as Trump? And, you know, the way that the left works these days, we're just going to keep stringing the same descriptors to Trump over and over again. And what gets lost is that people aren't necessarily in the countryside. They're not voting. And I'm not defending Trump in any way.
No, I know. But I don't think you are.
But people, they're not coming at it like, oh, well, there's a guy who, you know, keeps women in place or this sort of thing. It's very local issues. And I mean, that's why I called. I mean, it's down to where does the Army Corps put the sand? You know, what type of outbuilding can I build on my farm? And just the complete with environmental regulators and nonprofits that mostly, you know, it's made up of people who aren't from the country. It's people from the city who come out there. And because we don't have what your guest is saying, actually going in and listening and saying, what are your needs? What do we need to do to make this work? You know, the countryside has become a really depressing place for a lot of people. And just, you know, hashtag rural tears or whatever isn't going to bring us all together, all of us at the bottom, all of the peasants in America, you know, because the stuff that I see is it's become total neo-feudalism. Here in Cascadia, you know, of a set of landowners and everybody that is involved with that, land managers at the state level, the nonprofit level, and then you have all these people who are just like, you know, when you watch a TV show set back in medieval England and places like that, you know, then you have all these people who take care of the goats and all that. I mean, that's literally where we are. And I think that I see it because I'm involved with a lot of different groups. When people just sit down with just a little bit of goodwill towards each other and actually listen, we can cross some bridges here and make it through some of these barriers. I fully believe that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your call this morning.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for adding
in. Thank you. That was fantastic.
Yeah. Anything to add to that, Kevin?
No. I mean, the caller put that very, very well, right?
Yeah.
The inability of the left to listen to rural people, to white working class people, right? Trump's success in a lot of ways is our failure. and identify that as someone who sees themselves as an anarchist on the left, that in fact, because we've not engaged in these conversations, because we've very often pointed fingers, we have not really properly listened to the fact that people can't feed their children and worried about losing their farms, et cetera, et cetera. And I think
he lied in the right ways to that, to people.
Certainly, yeah.
And
as any politician would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's that AstroTurf populism.
Yeah.
But, you know, that, you know, there's either the options of our last election were either that or complete condescension.
So
it's just kind of like, again, you know, neither of them are healthy choices. And so, again, I think you're absolutely right. We have failed as the left in being able to create a way to actually hear needs and work together to meet
but
them.
Let's not forget desire, too, right? I mean, that's one of the things, and that's why I use desire in the title of the book, because I think actually the desires that Trump really was able to access are real ones. Anger, fear, concern for feeding one's children, right? These are actually real desires and real emotions that people have. And it's really easy to say, hey, look, it's their fault. It's women's fault. It's immigrants' fault. It's Muslims' fault, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that solves a need that people have, right, emotionally. This solves an emotional need, a real quick one. You know what is not easy? Saying, well, you know what? We all need to get together and dismantle the system and create a new way of relating to one another. That doesn't always come with that jolt of caffeine that I at least, and maybe you all too, need this morning, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't come with that kind of immediate satisfaction.
It's long and it's complex.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it doesn't hit that same endorphin button as, you know, we got it. We know the problem is over there. We're going to get that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Be that, you know, a specific, yeah. Creed, religion, race, etc. That's it. That us and them. We can fight this. It does a very it does a great job of bonding one side, and yet it doesn't actually solve things. It creates bigger divides, and of course, it's not the world we want to live in. But it's very effective as an organizing tool.
And this set of desires that people have within themselves connect to relationships of power, right? Cornel West, I think, puts it very well that justice is what love looks like in public. And I think that's a real beautiful phrase.
That's beautiful, yeah.
And what I would is steal that and say
I'm sure
power.
He'd be fine with that.
Yeah, I think he'd be okay. That power is what desire looks like in public. Right? That there is a direct relationship to the desires and needs that human beings have and the kind of power relationships that exist in society. And unfortunately, in the English language, for power, we have one word. Most other languages, including the original Latin, have two. And that's the power, that's potestas and potentia, able and to be able, the power over, the power to, right? And in fact, the power to liberate and the power to repress are the same desire. They function in similar ways, right? Because we do want to repress certain ways of life, fascistic ways of life,
sure.
Repressive ways of life, oppressive and exploitative and controlling ways of life, right? And the idea that we just want to speak truth to power, to use an old tired slogan that unfortunately Al Gore, as I saw last night at the bookstore, has stolen to put on the cover of his recent turd storm.
Got a lot of damn gold, that man.
Right, but actually power is complex as needs and desires are complex. And I think we need to talk about how we want to arrange relationships of power and institutions and ways of life in society. And I think that's a different conversation than saying we want to speak truth to power or we need the power or we need to et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
you know where
totally.
I'm going there.
Well, we have only about 1 minute left. So there's in some, you know, if you wanted to leave people with one point, you got a 1 minute summary here, Kevin.
Okay. So the way I've ended my three talks that I've done thus far, I did one in Seattle and another in Olympia last weekend and then last night at Powell's, I've ended with a chant. It's a little silly.
Go for it.
But it's going to work. And I'm going to, and I totally screwed it up last night at the end of the talk. Totally, I won't do that today.
You can redeem yourself this morning.
Oh, I'm going to do my very best. So why don't I say the chant.
Sure.
And then we'll say it together. Does that sound good?
That sounds great.
And I think you probably have all heard this, and hopefully all those listening have heard this as well. And if you haven't, then you can join in the second time. The boss makes a dollar, I make a dime. That's why I poop on company time. Shall we say it together?
Yes.
Indeed.
The boss makes a dollar,
I make a dime. That's why I poop on company time.
And with that, we close another episode
Kevin Van Meter.
Of Positively Revolting. Kevin Van Meter, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Please come back. We have more to talk with you about.
I think possibly for months we have more to talk with you about. And coming right up, the beloved community at 9 o'clock. Stay tuned to KBOO, your community radio station, all day long.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 19th and Sunday, August 20th at Portland Metro Arts in Portland. The Montevilla Jazz Festival is a two-day festival that showcases the very best in original Portland jazz. The 2017 festival will host 12 performances over 2 days, featuring the Blue Cranes, Rebecca Kilgore, and is headlined by Portland's own Essiet Essiet. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 19th, and Sunday, August 20th at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.